We have forest life, we have animal life, we have everything. And for thousands, perhaps millions of years, these things have existed in balanced ratio to each other. They have survived side by side, limited by certain laws to prevent unbalance, developing certain traits to grow. There has been no bitter war of elements except by man. All the rest has been a growth. There's been struggle. Things haven't always been right. Animals and birds and fishes have made mistakes. But all in all of these imbalances are solved by nature itself. And the problems of things go on. Nature guards and protects generation and regeneration. It develops the power to nurse the sick and the weak. It develops the parental instincts which are necessary to provide later for human family relations. All these things are there and have been there since the dawn of time. Why does it then happen that now, after all this time, the only thing we can do with these powers of nature is destroy them, because we do not wish to fall into harmony with the laws of life themselves? The reason we don't want to live in harmony with life is because we don't understand life. We don't know what it is. If, like Lao Tzu, we sat on the side of a hill for a while, relaxed, and let the glory of creation shine into our hearts, we might do better. But instead of that, we are very busy running to one place for another, and for the most part, wasting a number of hours every day watching television programs that leave something, at least, to be desired. They're not very good. But in any event, we are not taking advantage of the great nature mandala. We are not able to see God in nature. We see God as something sitting up in a throne, aloof, like some high-bred politician. We think of God as a despot, a benevolent despot, perhaps. But this God has people he likes and he doesn't like. He has beliefs he believes in himself and others he'll never believe in. We are never able to quite make out of this mysterious power the kind of parent we would all like to have. Something has happened and cruelty has come in, apparently. We don't realize that cruelty in this case was merely a correction that was very necessary. But if anything goes different to our wishes, it is cruel. If anything frustrates our ambitions, it is cruel. If anything shortens our lives from our own bad habits, that is cruelty. And we begin to recognize nature only as a frustration, as something that is eternally trying to prevent us from doing what we want to do. So to meet this emergency, science came into existence. Science took the attitude that there must be some way to get over the problem of nature always interfering with the will of man. It was easy enough because science wasn't much troubled by theology anyway. So he didn't have to work that phase of the matter to any degree. So what science did very definitely was to try to find means of evading or avoiding the consequences of conduct. Science wanted to build a wall around the individual so that he could live within a more limited area, but exactly according to his own pleasures. He could get rid of the world by simply retiring from it. But he couldn't get any further than nature because there was no else place for him to retire to. So here we have now, after nearly 50 years of rapid scientific progress and a couple of wars and the panics and epidemics, all these things, we are faced with the fact that things don't seem to be right. There are problems we're not able to handle. So science is now quietly dropping back a little. Science is now emphasizing only certain phases of its beliefs. And the average scientist is beginning to think in theological terms. And also in these worlds of political chicanery, more and more people and more nations are beginning to realize that the divine government is the only one that will ever last, that all the others are very temporary. And where the individual breaks the rules of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, he's in trouble. So that suddenly we come face to face with the fact that the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount are rather important. Now, the Ten Commandments are very important because every one of them is based upon circumstances you can see in the mandala of the natural law. Every problem that comes up is handled in a way that reveals its cause and consequence. The only way you can avoid these recognitions is to ignore the patterns from which they are developed. And these laws or these patterns are absolutely necessary. I think I told you some time ago that a group of scholars are deciding to rewrite the Sermon on the Mount. And among the things they didn't like was, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Well, that was kind of not exactly according to Hoyle. The meek was the last thing anybody wanted to be. So they had decided that that Christ didn't say it, which was the quickest way of getting rid of it, in their estimation. But whoever said it, or if it was actually composed by the printer of the book, it is still true. These truths are shown in nature. They are derived not from the mysterious depths of some cloistered laboratory. They are in the daily transactions of existence. They are in the relations of husband and wife, parent and child, church and state, everything. There are evidences that this material world in which we live is a magnificent diagram, a wonderful picture of the things that might be and should be. And it all began with the Garden of Eden, so to say. It began with an earth and a world in balance, everything in equilibrium, therefore without conflict, without difficulty, without dissipation, without pain. But the individual himself, as it says in Genesis in a rather crude way, decided to do it his way. And from that time came the troubles. The individual, breaking away from universal law, has not yet realized that something he can't win. We will continue to try to do it. We will call people intelligent who fight against truth. But you cannot do a thing that is contrary to this tremendous over-pattern on which the world is suspended. This, in the Oriental method, was the basis of the mandala diagram. The diagram was a picture of the invisible government of the world. It was also the picture of the invisible government of man by the invisible power inside of man. The human being from within himself has the answer to all things. The human being outside of himself has no answers that are legitimate. So, here we are coming into another century, coming into another time of testing. And what we need definitely to is to find again the foundations of nature. Where would we find these foundations? They are not to be found really in the present generation, although they are hinted at. We have to cover the whole pattern of human life. The mandala is a living, moving thing. It is not a picture painted on something and left to hang on a wall. The real mandala is a moving universe, every moment changing, every moment growing, every moment setting up new patterns and new privileges and new powers. But always in peace, always in wisdom, always in love, so that the creating power becomes, so to say, the deity behind all change, because it is ordains all change. Change must come because there must be growth. Things must unfold, and it is the purpose of nature that all things shall shall, in the fullness of time, become divine, a part of the pattern. Now, when we go to another phase of this whole situation, we go again into the political and social phases. What is the great government? What is the invisible government of the world that we hear about in the midst of the cloistered Himalayan heights? What is this invisible government? It is the government of the internal over the external. It is the government of that which is locked within, and which is being deprived of the right of expression. Day by day and year by year, we must break down the wall between ourselves on the outside and ourselves on the inside. This is something far worse than the Berlin Wall. It is the wall that we have built around our conduct to completely separate it from our conscience. We have an internal life, sufferings, saddened, finally, practically destroyed, by the corruptions of the external and has no more strength to fight back. We are gradually allowing the outer world to destroy the inner life. Well, we say we're allowing it, but unfortunately or fortunately, nature doesn't take this attitude. Nature will never allow the outside to win against the inside. The outside is a dependency. It is something that is built upon inner life. The life of the outside is on the inside. And no way can we make it stay on the outside and continue to grow. We are fighting constantly to maintain a system that can never survive. We are determined to sacrifice life, generations, our own children, our human conscience, and all that is important and sacred in life. We are willing to sacrifice all this in order to keep on doing the things that are wrong. Now, some of the things that are wrong seem to be very pleasant, but actually, they are not. Nothing is pleasant that does not service the purposes and needs of mankind. Now, another thing that comes up in this kingdom of nature is the vegetables. Now, actually, our garden is the garden of the gods, as the Muslim calls it. We are really living in the presence of the most beautiful garden that is imaginable. And not only is it a beautiful garden, but it is the basis of health. And just the same honesty and the keeping of the laws that we have to live socially and politically, we must apply these same laws to our own personal habits. The human body is part of a perfectly working mechanism which we gradually pervert, destroy, or damage. We do it largely from the same old motive, profit. We have become accustomed to extravagant living simply because it makes money for somebody, because it is a passion, a kind of likeness which makes us all happy because it tastes good. Out of this comes all kinds of illness because we have broken the laws of natural nutrition. And whether it's nutrition or the other things, Food and Drug Act, all these things, we are breaking the rules in order to do what we please, and we're getting sicker every day. Therefore, little by little, we're beginning to understand that there are things we simply can't do without paying an awful price for doing them. Now, we're coming into a new generation here very shortly. And this generation will be slowly retired to the point where it is a great mandala on the wall of heaven. This 20th century will be a picture to show advantages and disadvantages, show growth and failure, will show peace and war. And it will sum up to show what we have gained by 100 years of civilization, so-called. We will also begin to understand what is the matter with our schools, what is the matter with our personal lives, why we are not doing better with our children, why we are overwhelmed with narcotics. All these things will be obviously there. And those who come after us will look at it, and they'll say, well, it's too bad. They should have done better than that. In the meantime, if we're not careful, they will be doing something just as bad. We will do everything poorly as long as selfishness and gain and greed are the primary factors in life. And how are we going to get rid of them? Well, there have been some who have done it. Santa Teresa has done it. And several of the great saints of the early church, Saint Francis de Assis, has done it. There were also in the other parts of the world sages, teachers, and wise people who have made that adjustment. The Greeks made it. Probably the greatest of them all was Pythagoras. He paid with his life. Plato, he made it. And we have given him some credit, but we suffer from a bad translation of him by Dr. Jowett. We also have found other great people. We know the world teachers made it, but we do not want to make it their way. We do not want to make it by growing. We want to make it by keeping quiet and letting heaven bestow the benefits. Heaven doesn't work that way. We are beginning to realize it is a mistake to spoil children. Heaven found that out a million years ago. It is a mistake to spoil people of the 20th century. All these things are part of a great religious mystery. The great paintings of law are not on the walls of Karnak, but on the walls of heaven. Everything around us teaches us to honor God, teaches us to find God in all things, and to find this God as a principle of integrity in all relationships of life. We are given the privilege of growing, and as we grow, to overcome the mistakes which have made past experience more difficult or uncomfortable. We are perfectly privileged to grow whenever we want to, but there is no one that is going to thrust growth upon us. If we prefer to remain as we are and fight with our relatives for the rest of our lives, we have the privilege of doing so. But somewhere in the great out there, these things come to pattern. Nature points out clearly that the end of its processes of growth is not annihilation. Nature does not build things age after age, century after century, in order to destroy it. Growth is not intended to end in dissolution. Growth is said to end in completion, in perfection, in attainment. Therefore, there can be no concept of completion apart from the correction of the mistakes with which we are burdened. We have carried some of these mistakes to the beginning of history. Others we have changed. We have a school system that could put these mistakes and how we made them in perfect sequence. We could take a school system and work out a study and the relationship of action and reaction that would be astonishing. We could prove conclusively that every misfortune of man has arisen directly from a dishonest effort on the part of the human being to cheat nature or his fellow man. These things are part of rules that we cannot break and cannot destroy. They're all the part of the law. But above it all is this beautiful, beautiful thought. The fact that we find God in the peace of the garden. It is said that God walked first in the garden. And then while it was a garden, he came every day in the cool of the evening. It is also true that the God in us can walk in the garden. It is perfectly true that if we will get some of the weeds out of it, there will be room for us to walk in the garden instead of falling over the dead shrubbery and the burrs and difficulties. We need to know that there is the nearest communion with God will not be in a building made by men, but be in the great house made by deity itself. The universe is the great house. The universe is the place where we find deity in the innermost and the outermost, and find reality as the simplest system of simply being kind. We find all these very common virtues. Why not teach these to children? Why not put out a textbook for school children, emphasizing and proving conclusively, scientifically, that selfishness can never win, that dishonesty can never pay, that weakness can never end in growth, and compromise can never end in happiness. If we put all these factors together and work with them, we can make a very sizable proof, not only of the importance of nature to us and to the ages that come after us, but also the spiritual communion which we achieve through contact with deity in the actual workings of the universal plan. We must do some of these things, or else we will find ourselves deprived of so many privileges that life will hardly be worth living. There are many complaints now about the unhappiness of things. This unhappiness will continue until we realize that out in the meadow, flowers of 1,000 colors, with many petals and few petals, each one a perfect organism, something beautiful and wonderful, from the tiniest little blade coming through the earth to the old sequoia trees with their thousands of years of growth. Nature is a great temple, a great house of quietudes, where we can see nature growing in its own way, which is God coming out from within these forms into manifestation as the rules and laws of good life. We can all do something to help ourselves, and we'll do much better if instead of looking for some way to think ourselves along with troubles, to think ourselves into the curing of them. And if we get to work and make a good job of that, the future will be better. And we will realize that there can no longer be an atheist, because no one can explain the mystery of life by atheism. No one can decry the presence of a deity. No one can say that all these things were put together for no purpose, by no power, and that all things are one accident. All accidents lead to trouble. All intents solve troubles. And at the present moment, we are living too much by accident, and in the years ahead, to solve our problems, we must live by intent, by a voluntary contribution with the world and with life and with the plan for which we were created. There has to be a plan. It is visible everywhere except in the human mind, which has finally decided that it wishes to make its own plans at all costs. It has made a number of plans, most of them pretty bad. We've got to come back to think with God instead of merely thinking of Him. We have to think with the law instead of standing back, living our own lives and talking about the law. Live the principles we believe, and heaven will return in all its glory, and peace will come back to this troubled earth. Thank you.